Good morning, everyone. Certainly appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And these are some of the information I would have provided the assembled group earlier today, except that I was a little bit taken off script by the kindness of the Farm Bureau and certainly Bob Stallman, a good friend. I wanted to make sure that folks know that we are aggressively promoting implementation of the Farm Bill. Many of you have heard me give reports from time to time about the disaster assistance program. We are now about 503,000 payments. $4.3 billion have been provided. The Dairy Margin Protection Program, the deadline expired on December 19th. We issued a release today. Over 50% of producers, roughly 23,000, somewhere between 23 and 24,000 producers, are participating for 2015 in the Dairy Margin Protection Program. This was a result of 556 events that were held by USDA around the country explaining the program. There were 428 demonstrations of the web-based tool. Over 60,000 pieces of direct mail were sent to producers to let them know about the program. Of the 50% or so producers who signed up for 2015, roughly 55% of those producers purchased additional buy-up coverage. So we are pleased with the performance and the understanding of the program and the participation of that important program. As you know, the deadline for the signing up and making the election under the Agriculture Risk Coverage Program or the Price Loss Coverage Program is coming up effective March 31st. We've already begun to see activity in this area. 142,541 operations have started the process of reallocating their base acres, and over 24,000 farms have already, 34,170 farms have already started the process of the election of ARC and PLC. So we will obviously see a pickup of those numbers as the weeks and months continue. Want to encourage folks who are in a position to make an election. They've looked at the programs, they've run the numbers, they're pretty well certain as to what they're going to do. Encourage folks to do and to make that election as soon as they're ready to make it. What we want to avoid is any kind of funneling of these decisions in the latter part of March, because it will obviously create significant staff issues and potentially technology issues if we have hundreds of thousands of people waiting until March 30th to make the election. So hopefully folks who are in a position to make the election are using the opportunity now to do so. We have we'll be announcing on Wednesday the first round of awardees under the Regional Conservation Partnership Program. We're very pleased with the activity in that area. Over 600 pre-applications, whittled it down to a couple hundred more full-scaled applications, and I think our team's done a really good job of national and priority areas getting resources. So we're looking forward to that announcement in Arizona on Wednesday. We've got stacks up and going, but we've begun making transition payments under the Cotton Transition Program. 184,000 farms have already received $539 million. Under that program. So Research Foundation up and going, SCO crop insurance launched, farm credit, we've increased the level on microloans now to 50,000. So there's been quite a bit of activity, export promotion programs back in play, helping to fund trade shows and working to reduce barriers around the country. So it's been a very, very active year in 2014, and we'll continue to see that kind of activity in 2015. There are going to be four issues that I want to just really briefly address in terms of forward motion at the department. We will continue to focus on beginning farmers and the effort of the Deputy Secretary. We're announcing today the availability of $18 million under our Beginning Farmer and Rancher Development Program, so that requests for applications for those resources will be announced today. We are continuing to look for ways in which we can attract new people to farming, embracing diversity, and particularly among boards and commissions, encouraging folks to understand what the new face of farming will look like and making sure that we're prepared for it. We're also going to continue to work in this year of International Year of Soil. We're going to continue focusing on soil health and water quality. It's one of the reasons why we're excited about the RCPP program. We think this is a new opportunity to leverage and expand significantly resources in conservation. Excited by the announcements at the end of last year, which will flow into this year on the development of new ecosystem markets, opportunities in the Dakotas with Chevrolet on carbon capture of a working ranch and grassland area, water programs cropping all across the United States, habitat programs as well. So this is a new opportunity for us to continue to invest in soil and water health. We'll continue focusing on the work on climate and weather variation. We expect and anticipate that the work that was done in 2014 will lead to an identification throughout the United States of various vulnerabilities, which will then allow us to begin the process of identifying how we might be able to help producers and educate producers about adaptation and mitigation strategies. And then a new effort, which I'm now announcing today, we're going to be directing the Beginning Farmer and Rancher Advisory Council to take the next 6 months or so of their work and begin asking a series of questions about land ownership in the country. Approximately one-third of the farmland in this country is owned by non-operating farm owners. And this has an impact, and potentially we'll see this percentage increase over time. With the aging nature of our farm family and our farmers, there is the potential for more and more land ownership to get in the hands of folks who are actually not working the land or who are not on the land. I want to make sure that the policies that we have in play at USDA continue to encourage those non-operating landowners to understand the long view as well as the short view, to understand the importance of working with beginning farmers and ranchers to provide access to ground and also to continue to invest in conservation. There may be some short-term pressures with non-farm land ownership to focus on high cash rents and not investing a great deal in conservation because it you don't necessarily see the short-term benefit, but the long-term requires those kinds of investments. So I want to make sure that, you know, we are taking a look at how we're handling all of those issues, what information we need to obtain. We're doing a survey. NASA's doing a survey that's going to give us additional information and data about the extent of non-farm land ownership. I think of myself and my circumstances. My wife and I own a farm. Neither one of our boys are liable to become farmers. The question is who will farm that land while we invest in conservation practices because we understand the long-term benefit to the soil. That's not necessarily always the case. I think the last time this issue was really looked at in great detail may have been 1937 for different reasons. But if you look at the report that was issued by the committee in 1937, some of the language, some of the observations concerning farm country might still be true today. So I thought it would be a good idea to take a forward look at this issue so that we can reassure the farm community and the agricultural community that we're not only focused on the present and implementation of the Farm Bill, but we also have an eye towards the longer-term future.
Network and AgriPulse. We have a GOP majority now in the Congress, but from the administration's perspective, what should be on the congressional agenda, what should not be on the agenda, and what could that there might be areas for compromise?
Well, Jeff, I think one of the areas that we're helpful and looking forward to working with our colleagues in Congress is on the trade issue. With the president's announcement in Cuba, with the ongoing negotiations with the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the need for the president to have a trade promotion authority, we think there are opportunities for us to work with Congress. It's going to require us, I think, us being those who believe that there is an opportunity for trade to encourage more market opportunities for farmers and to create the jobs that we know are associated with trade agreements. We need to do a better job of educating folks about the importance of trade. Maybe farmers understand and appreciate that we've seen 130% increase in exports in the last 10 years because of free trade agreements. Maybe they understand that a million jobs are connected to those exports that are at record levels, but I'm not sure everybody else understands that. And I think if people begin to understand the enormity of the opportunity that the Trans-Pacific Partnership has for job growth in the economy across the board, and for what it can mean to agriculture if the agreement is a solid, high standards agreement, we'll perhaps get more support for that, and we'll get more support for the Trade Promotion Authority that will allow us not to have to go through a series of amendments to a trade agreement. So that's one area. I would continue to hope, notwithstanding some of the concerns that have been expressed by some members of Congress, that we would finally work collaboratively to solve a broken immigration system. The President's actions, while it resolves and helps to a certain extent, are not the solution that anybody knows is needed. Sure, we need continued investment in border security, but we also need a way of giving people the stability and predictability of a system that works so that we can bring folks out of the shadows, get that agricultural workforce stabilized, get a guest worker system that is pegged to what we actually need from year to year. So those are two areas. You know, I had a nice conversation and a good opportunity to visit with Representative Conaway. I also reached out to Congressman Scott, who's a ranking member, on issues involving nutrition. And I know that there will continue to be questions on nutrition programs, but I think it will also give us an opportunity to educate people about the breadth of the impact of SNAP. On the way here, I read an interesting 2012 study on the positive nutritional impact that SNAP has had on young children. And the fact is that families who participate in SNAP, who need SNAP, who have children 0 to 5, see better health outcomes because of participation in a program like SNAP. We know there's a poverty reduction aspect to this. We know there's an economic stimulus connected to it. We also know that there are ways in which we can do a better job of putting able-bodied folks to work who are currently receiving SNAP, reducing the numbers. And with the approved economy, we are expecting and anticipating those numbers to come down. So there I think there's opportunity there for working collaboratively so long as, you know, there is not a desire to unilaterally or just for the sake of getting to a budget number, taking a look at a program that's actually doing a pretty good job.
Owen? Mr. Secretary, could you expand a little bit on your tax reform discussion yesterday?
Sure.
And its impact on agriculture. Can it happen?
Can it happen? Well, I suppose anything's possible. Maureen, you've been around long enough to know that. It should happen, right? It should happen. And we actually, I had a brief conversation with Representative Conaway about, Chairman Conaway about this. You know, as we take a look at this issue of non-farm operator ownership, the question is, why wouldn't people who own farmland, if it's appreciated and if it's a opportunity, why wouldn't they want to consider selling that land to a beginning farmer? And why wouldn't they be encouraged to do so as opposed to holding on to it until they die, getting a stepped-up basis under the estate tax laws, and then having their heirs sell it, and then having it sold primarily to someone who is already in a mature farming operation who can afford to pay the highest and best price for the land? The answer is the income tax. There is no incentive whatsoever for someone in my circumstance to even think about selling the land. A land that's appreciated 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times, you are going to be faced with one heck of a bill, and you know that if you wait long enough, you won't have to pay any of that. So I think the first step in the process is to educate people about this issue, because invariably when you talk to farm groups about tax issues, it almost always gravitates to the estate tax discussion. And the reality of the estate tax is that hardly anybody pays it. It's a handful of people who pay it. And there really are not very many examples of people who had to sell the farm to pay what estate tax was owed. So it's an issue that gets a lot of attention but isn't going to solve for the vast majority of a problem. The income tax could, if it was structured right, create the kind of incentive that would encourage my wife and I to think about, hey, that young farmer down the road who needs access to land, instead of constantly charging him a cash rent, which allows him to build up no equity, why not figure out a way to transfer that land to him at a way that we don't necessarily have to pay an unreasonable amount of tax, and we'll feel good about it. They'll have access to land, these returning veterans. Can you allow the basis that I have, the tax basis of the land that I have, to be transferred to that beginning farmer so that essentially it's not a taxable event when I sell it? And then maybe I would be willing to get that treatment. Maybe I would be willing to discount the fair market value of that land a bit, because at the end of the day, I'll end up with more money in my pocket. That's one way to do it. There are probably 1,000 ways to do it. The challenge here is to get people to think about doing it, and then to make sure that as people think seriously about tax reform generally, right, but getting rid of deductions and so forth, that they understand the significance of this little discussion in terms of land ownership and the future care of the soil and the land.
Hi, Secretary. Tiffany Stecker with the Environment and Energy Publishing. You spoke a little bit about climate change and your work in climate change. It seems like there's still a difficulty in the agricultural community to discuss this. I went to an event yesterday on water availability, and a lot of the statements were preceded with, "I'm not a climate scientist, but I don't want to say what is causing this, but." So I'm wondering if USDA is making an effort to, maybe improve the communication around this in agriculture.
Well, I think we did as part of the climate change, the Midwest Climate Change Hub, we did a fairly extensive survey of Midwestern farmers. 17,000 to 18,000 producers were asked in the survey. Memory serves me, roughly somewhere between 4,500 and 5,000 actually responded, so it was a fairly good response. And a series of questions about climate change and weather variation. And what was interesting to me about the survey was there wasn't a great deal of interest in discussing this in the context of climate change, but there was a large interest in discussing it in the relationship to weather variation. So to me, we're dealing with semantics here. I think the notion of climate change for some is politically charged, so they prefer not to get into that. Okay, fair enough. As long as the conversation can continue in some vein, if you want to talk about weather variation, I'm fine with that. Let's talk about weather variation, and let's talk about what you're seeing on the farm, what you're seeing in your soil, what you're seeing in water, quality and quantity, how that's impacting decisions that you're making today, and would you be interested in information in terms of longer-term strategies? And the vast majority of producers I talk with say, yes, I'd like to know more about this. Which is why we set up the climate hubs. It's why we're doing the vulnerability assessments. It's why we're going to identify technologies. It's why we're engaged in the Climate Smart Agriculture Alliance. It's why we're engaged in the Global Research Alliance and the Open Data effort, all designed to try to get the conversation started in a way that people are comfortable with. I think we try to force these conversations into territory that people are uncomfortable with, and when we do that, we end up not having the conversation. I like to find areas and territory where people are comfortable talking about it, and I think you advance the cause a bit more effectively that way. And so, you're seeing now an understanding on the part of producers about the need for the more ground is covered, the chances are better that scarce resources will be retained. You're seeing a better understanding of precision agriculture and the need to be very precise about how inputs are applied. You're seeing the need for opportunities for cover crops and double cropping emerge, 350% increase in cover crop activity. You're seeing farmers wanting to know better nutrient management strategies, the timing of applications of certain chemicals. All that's taken place. And so I think, there's positive forward movement here. But the reality is that, as I said earlier today, at a meeting with the Iowa folks, we didn't get into this overnight, and we're not going to make all of the adjustments in a single year, and we're certainly not going to see dramatic changes in a year, but we are seeing changes. We are seeing reductions through conservation, and I think with this regional conservation partnership program, we're going to accelerate the timelines and the acceptance of conservation even more than it already is, which is at record levels.
Mr. Secretary, Ron Hayes, Oklahoma Farm Report. Country of origin labeling. If nothing changes, we may have a final decision from WTO sometime this year, perhaps. Congress, in their appropriations messages to you, indicated they were really seeking your advice about how you fix this thing. How do we fix country of origin labeling?
I love my friends in Congress. Look, it's really very simple. Congress says label. Congress says tell the consumer something that has exclusively been raised, slaughtered, processed, et cetera, in the U.S., which requires people to segregate, to separate those animals that have been handled solely in the U.S. with those animals that have not. As soon as you segregate, WTO comes in and says you can't do that. Now, we're appealing that. We win the appeal. We can keep doing what we're doing. If we lose the appeal, the only way you can create a synergy between what Congress is currently asking us to do in the WTO is for Congress either to rescind and repeal the law, and you get into a voluntary situation, or come up with a different direction to us to come up with a more generic labeling that doesn't require segregation. That is the answer. Now, there are a lot of folks who don't like that answer. I get that. But that's the deal. I challenged our team at USDA to be as creative as they possibly can be. They've done that twice to come up with what we proposed. And I came and said, can we do it one more time? They said, Mr. Secretary, you just can't square the circle here. Something's got to give you. We either have to win at the WTO or Congress has to take action. And, they ask us to give opinions. They know what our opinion is. It was just a nice, convenient way to get the budget bill done. We'll respond by May 1, which is what we're required to do. And what they're going to hear is, guys, you're going to have to repeal this or you're going to have to create a different set of directions to us that's more generic.
Mr. Secretary, right here, Lee Maddox with the Tennessee Farm Bureau, and it's well noted your passion for the ag industry and as was noted this morning. But I'm just wondering how often you get the chance to share that with the president.
I share it with the president in a multitude of ways. First of all, the president requires and asks his cabinet to send him a note every week on any issue that is of interest or concern to us or something that we think he needs to know about. I don't write those notes every week because as a former governor, I can only imagine the amount of paperwork the president has to review. The briefing books are pretty thick. I write when I really have something to say, and I have found in doing that the president almost always responds to what I to the comments that I make. So that's one way. The second way, the president has established a set of regular meetings with individual members of the cabinet. I was one of the first, if not the first, cabinet member to have one of those regular meetings. And that's on a sort of an ongoing loop where we actually get a chance to sit and visit with the president pretty much one-on-one. And I use those opportunities to discuss issues. One such issue some time ago resulted in the president's interest in pollinators and its impact on agriculture and the fact that, nearly a third of our crops are impacted and affected by the pollinators, and that led to a pollinator task force that's now resulting in us putting resources to work in our conservation programs to create habitat, pollinator initiative through CRP, a variety of other actions. There is an opportunity from time to time to travel with the president if our schedules are coordinated, and when that happens, the president almost always gives us an opportunity to spend a few minutes with him. Most recently, I was out in California for a monument designation, and I had that opportunity to travel and to see the president. And then there is the indirect communication with the president, which takes place more frequently, obviously, with the chief of staff and with the policy council people I speak with those folks on a very regular basis and email them on a very regular basis. I'd say we probably have conversations and communications nearly once or twice a week. So there are a multitude of ways for me to express my concerns or questions or concerns to the president and the vice president. Chris?
Thank you. Chris Clayton, DTN. Back on trade, with the 2016 elections coming up, is there a window essentially that closes on the Trans-Pacific Partnership sometime this year if you aren't able to see any movement in Congress on TPA?
Chris, I will tell you, I think the stakes are so large in reference to the TPP that you cannot create a situation in which, if it doesn't happen by a date certain, it's not going to happen. I think there is a true commitment on the part of Ambassador Froman and his team at USTR to try to bring these negotiations to somewhat of a culmination and head, given the momentum that's been built the last several months, sometime in early 2015. I think we're seeing, movement from time to time on our issues with Japan. I think we're continuing to work with Vietnam on several critical issues. So there has always been forward momentum, and I think there's a series of meetings that are scheduled here over the course of the next couple of months that are trying to build on that momentum. Here's why this is so doggone important. And not all everybody understands the significance of this. I say, it's 40% of gross domestic product. It's a third of all global trade. Folks who are in this world kind of get those numbers. But here's the number that I think people need to focus on. There are roughly 500 million middle-class consumers in the Asian countries that we are dealing with and discussing in the context of TTIP. That number is projected to grow in the Asian area to over 2 billion in the next 15 years. One generation. That is a huge increase in consumers who will be looking for higher level, higher quality agricultural products, the stuff that we excel in at USD in the U.S. So there's this enormous market opportunity. That's going to create jobs because every $1 billion of sales creates 6,500 jobs. So it's estimated the entire trade agreement could impact 600,000 jobs here in the United States. Now, that includes all the products, but ag obviously has a piece of this. So it's new market opportunities for what we grow, what we raise, hundreds of thousands of potential jobs. It is also about making sure that the void that would be created by not having an agreement isn't filled by a series of one-off agreements between the countries we're currently negotiating with that do not include the United States. So if we don't do an agreement, there's nothing preventing Malaysia from having an agreement with Canada or Mexico having an agreement with Vietnam. And if we're not part of that, then we're at a competitive disadvantage because they have a little sweeter deal. So we don't want to cede market opportunity to competition because we couldn't get a multilateral deal. And then there is the final piece of this, which is if you don't get TPP, and if you're not concerned about the one-offs that could take place, you ought to be concerned about China's effort to develop an Asian trade agreement that will not be concerned about the labor standards of people producing products, won't have as much of a concern about the environmental impact of how those products are produced, and will be solely about buying and selling. And when that happens, this balance that we're trying to create in Asia, balancing China, India, the U.S. interests, gets out of balance. So there's a national security imperative, I think, a point that can be made, about the importance of these agreements. So when you start looking at the totality of why this is important and what we stand to lose if we can't get it done, you start to begin to see a pathway to how it could get done and how you might have trade promotion authority making it a little easier to get it done. So I don't think there's an end date here. I think we're focused on trying to get this done.
Mr. Secretary, Lane Nordland, Northern Ag Network, Montana, Wyoming, and the Western Dakotas, with increased terror activity across the world, what are some of the steps that USDA is including or preparing for and possible agri-terrorism possibilities across our nation and the world when it comes to trade? And so there's no restrictions for those producers out there or manufacturers. Many of our producers at home are concerned about some of those possibilities.
Trying to bring the mood of this down here a little bit. Well, the USDA has a variety of ways in which it tries to address that question without raising undue concern or fear or uncertainty about the supply of food. I want to say that our view is that we've got a safe food supply, and we work every day to ensure its safety. You know, there is first and foremost internal to the U.S. a series of requirements that we require food processing facilities to go through in terms of testing. And when tests basically determine there's a problem with a product, that product either doesn't get into the stream of commerce or gets removed from the stream of commerce. There is a concerted effort to work in partnership with the Customs and Border folks to do sufficient testing of incoming product to ensure that it is safe. I will say that we're asking at this point in time for sort of a recalibration of the fees that are paid by folks bringing stuff in and folks exporting stuff so that we can be assured of having the technology and the personnel to do that screening and that testing adequately, effectively, and it will require somewhat of a rebalancing of who pays the fees between passenger air travel and cargoes, but we're working with the industry to try to get to consensus on that effort. There is the research effort that's underway, collaborative research efforts that can include partners like USDA and the Department of Defense, making sure that we are keeping an eye on what is out there, what's on the internet, what people are talking about in the chatter that's analyzed, and making sure that we either know the answer if something were to happen, by that I mean a vaccine or virus, and making sure that there are adequate supplies, and to make sure that we have the detection, surveillance efforts in place to ensure safety and security. So I think it's a sort of a multi-leveled effort. One would hope that we will continue to be vigilant because we understand there's a risk here and we understand the kind of uncertainty that could be created with something like that. Jerry, you had your arm up. Were you going to ask that question, Jerry?
No. Okay. I was going to ask, in your conversation with Congressman Conaway, did he bring up...
Jerry Hagstrom, the Hagstrom Report. In your conversation with Congressman Conaway, did he bring up what he plans to do on food stamps? I've heard some concern expressed here that if Congress starts cutting food stamps, that could also lead to calls for cuts in crop insurance, not to match them exactly, but to go along with them.
Well, the chairman was quite helpful in his comments to me that he had a couple of areas that he was focusing on. He wanted, and I think this was his term, a soup to nuts review of the SNAP program with no foregone conclusion attached to that review. In other words, in his mind, he hasn't reached any conclusions about what should or should not happen in that SNAP program. He recognizes he has some members who have some strong feelings about this, but he himself wants to sort of make sure that there's an examination of the program given its size. And I think that's understandable, and I think if that's the approach that we will continue to work with the chairman and the committee on providing the information and making sure that they have a full awareness of what the SNAP program does and who it helps and what we're trying to do in terms of fraud and mistakes. which we're now at record lows, that we are continually vigilant about that. So that's kind of where that's where the discussion was. And you know, I think that there are always places where there may be disagreements or where some folks may think a reform here or a reform there might be helpful. Certainly there has been some discussion about the equities within crop insurance and whether the subsidy percentages are where they need to be, that type of thing. But I don't know that there's a great deal of sentiment. I hope there's not a great deal of sentiment for reopening all of the Farm Bill. You know, I still have the bruises and cuts and memories of the battle over the last couple of years. I don't know why anybody want to get back into that process. So hopefully whatever is discussed is strategic and surgical as opposed to, you know, let's reopen the whole thing because we got a new group of folks in charge and they've got a different agenda. I just didn't get the sense from Representative Conaway that's his approach. I haven't talked to Senator Roberts about it other than to read his public comments, which he's sort of in the same area and probably nobody more vigilant and more defensive defender of crop insurance than Senator Roberts.
Mr. Secretary, from your perspective, at what point would a reduction in taxpayer subsidies as a part of the crop insurance program threaten the overall function of risk management tools for all farmers?
Jeff, I don't know that I necessarily have a precise answer to that question. I would say that there are things around the edges that we've proposed in the past in budgets that that don't compromise the program, but ensure that it's easy to defend and easy to explain to people who are not farmers. I don't think there's any question at USDA in this administration, in the Congress, and in the countryside that people understand that crop insurance is the principal risk management tool, and that if we didn't have that tool, what we'd have is go back to the days of appropriations bills that don't necessarily deal just with the disaster at hand, but then get laden with a whole series of other requests from other parts of Congress that aren't related to agriculture, but they know it's a bill that's going to go through the process. And at the end of the day, taxpayers are better off with this system than they are with no risk management tool. So I don't think we're going to get into a situation where we're jeopardizing participation. I think producers understand this is critically important. And now, with no direct payments, probably even more so, because that ARC and PLC is not designed to make you whole. It's designed to keep you afloat, but it doesn't make you – it's not going to make you wealthy, and it's not going to solve all the problems.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you.
Okay. Well, am I going to get branded here?
No, I wanted to see if you would pose with this since we didn't get a good picture of it.
All right.
And if you could tell us again how much that means to you.
You want me at the podium?
Yeah. Oh, beautiful. No, that's beautiful. That's beautiful.
Okay. How am I supposed to tell you how much this means to me?
Okay. After I get the nice picture.
Okay.
Now you go.
Okay. My first memory of getting this job actually involves Jerry Hagstrom. I don't know how good it is, but he... But Jerry introduced me to the aggressiveness of Washington media. And I don't remember precisely what the question was, but the question understandably had somewhat of a skepticism about whether a guy who grew up in a city who didn't farm would be able to do this job. And I'm sure that there were probably some members of the Farm Bureau around the country that had the same question. And I suspect that there might even be some of you folks here covering ag secretaries who may have had the same set of questions. So when, after 6 years or so of doing this job, you get the folks who had understandable skepticism or questions doing something like what happened today, it means a lot. I think it means a level of appreciation for the job we've done at USDA, which I am proud of. It means that that you're doing a good job. And when the people that you work for say you're doing a good job, it's human nature to be touched by that. So I'm very honored by this and very appreciative of it. And it means so much more when it comes from folks who, you know, who just didn't know. Being governor of Iowa is a great responsibility, and it is a great part of my life, but it doesn't necessarily convince people that I know how to be the Secretary of Agriculture. And, you know, people say, why do you keep this job when folks generally don't stay as long as I have? It's because I work with great people and I work for great people. And I see people's dedication. I see their love of country. I see their connection to the land that is deep, that runs. That in a sense, when a farmer walks onto that farm that he or she owns, there is literally a connection between their feet on the ground and the roots in the soil. I mean, they are rooted there. And I think it's important for people like me to have opportunities like this so that we can do a little better job of explaining to folks who are like me how great the people who farm are. And I know it pains people to hear criticisms and concerns, and I think oftentimes those concerns and criticisms are not warranted, but it is just simply because people don't know. And I'll tell you, if they did know, they'd have the same feeling and sentiment that I have. So this is really cool. I've got a 5-year-old grandson who is a very curious fella, and I'm sure when he sees this, his first thought might be his little sister, and make sure that's not the case. Actually, it might be the other way around, little sister, maybe. But I think it'll probably spur his interest in saying, you know, Granddad, what is that, and why did you get it, and what's it all about? And that gets me into the whole opportunity to teach him about the cattle industry and the livestock industry and farming. So thank you all.